if you successfully get them to come down from $320,000 to $315,000, because in your mind, you have just gotten $5,000 off of that sale price. But the way it pans out for you in your payments is you only save $360 per year, $30 a month. Like that's, you know what, that's like lunch for two. If on the other hand, you would say, I'll give you the price, $320, but I want $5,000 in seller credits, that comes back as $5,000 cash that pays some of your closing costs, right? So you actually have the effect of, at the time of buying the house, keeping $5,000 in your pocket. Welcome to Service and Wealth, the podcast dedicated to helping military personnel master their finances and achieve financial freedom. Our mission is to guide you through the ins and outs of planning, saving, and investing, and most importantly, how to balance savings so you can enjoy life now and retire with confidence. Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Ted Ehlert, with the Military Wealth Coaches Podcast, Service and Wealth. This is, it's kind of an eye-opener, right? Because, I feel like opened my eyes and it was December. Like literally already December. I don't know what happened in November. I feel like I don't even know what happened to September, October, like the weeks and the months are flying by. Oh, wait. Yeah, I do. Oh, it's called, you know, the school routine, the full-time dad routine. Just every day it's the same kind of, you know, some of you guys know, I don't know what percentage of y'all out there already have kids or not, but if you do, you know what the routine is, where it's like literally Groundhog's Day, you know. I find myself every morning and every evening as we're going through the routines, trying to be like, same thing as yesterday. Hey, we do this every day. And I'm like, you're only saying that to like calm yourself down, right? Because it means absolutely nothing to your kid or kids. And they're just being kids, right? And, you know, like time is super abstract concept. And, you know, what I found is when you're doing the same thing every day, the days just kind of blur all together. And then you wake up and it's the next month or the next year. And so yeah, so here we are. It's, I'm actually recording this on a Friday, so it's not technically, I'm kind of cheating and projecting like 2 days into the future, because, you know, we'll upload and air this episode on a Sunday like we try to every week. But yeah, you know, Thanksgiving is gone. We put up our tree, our Christmas tree, like a couple weeks before Thanksgiving, just because it seemed like the thing to do. The temperatures kind of dropped down and there wasn't much else going on, and it was a bit, a bit rainy out, cold and rainy. So it was like, let's just take the afternoon, evening, and let's get ready for Christmas. And now here we are, right? And before we know it, it's going to be over, and we're going to be launching into 2025 and January, and, you know, kind of like this. It's weird, you know, like January and February, they need like more real holidays. You know, there's a couple like federal days off, you know, you get like a 3-day weekend in January and a 3-day weekend in February. But for considering that these are like the middle of winter and like the days are super short and it's cold and there's not a lot of like morale coming from that part of it, I think we should like do a total makeover of our holidays, and we should turn Groundhog's Day into like a 96er, right? Like everybody in the military gets 4 days off for Groundhog's Day. And one, you know, obviously because it's in the middle of winter, so why not? But two, like, you know, you got to admit, like when you're at your unit, you're kind of doing the same thing every day and it kind of feels like Groundhog's Day, you know? So like, why not turn it, like elevate it into a holiday for everyone in uniform? I don't know, maybe write your congressperson or your senator about that instead of a pay raise. You know, give me a 4-day weekend in February so I can like get out of here, you know? All right. But anyway, you know, as far as that goes, what we are looking forward to in 2025 is hopefully turning more military members into homeowners. And ideally into real estate investors. You know, as we've said multiple times, and I'm sure you've heard it from, you know, I probably stole the label. I never heard anybody call this. I kind of stole it because I'm sure somebody else has thought of it. But I started calling myself like a real estate fanboy a couple years ago. And, you know, it's just because like I poured over reams of spreadsheets and Google Sheets and done all sorts of calculators and downloaded online investment calculators and then adapted the code into my own. And like, I'm just crunching these numbers and I'm like, okay, like everybody knows investing in the US stock market will make you rich in the long run. You know, 10.8% nominal return if you just invest in the S&P 500 and hold on for 10, 20, 30 years, you're going to get double digit returns on average. You know, and that's continuing to hold true. It's been holding true for over a century now. And I was like, that's got to be good enough, right? And then you start getting into things like real estate and you start seeing things like 15, 20, 25, even higher percent returns on investment on an annualized basis. And you're like, your mind's blown. You know, you're like, wait, I can take, instead of $100,000 saving up all this cash and putting it in the stock market for 20 years and averaging 10.8%, I could save up $100,000 and go into real estate and make twice as much. Like, that's insane. I mean, it's got to be a glitch, or there's got to be some sort of, you know, some sort of trick or catch, you know, because it just sounded too good to be true. You know, and when you do the numbers and you actually figure it out, like if I just had $100,000 right now that I parked in the S&P 500 and it performed as it has done for the past 100 plus years for the next 10, in 10 years, you know, like essentially on Thanksgiving of 2034, I'd have $293,000, which is pretty darn good. But with real estate and sort of looking at our own real estate portfolio, what we're getting, you know, if you're getting about twice that, so twice the annual rate of return on your investment or return on investment, you know, and so put in like 21%, you'd be sitting on 800,000, 801,000 to be exact. So like more than two and a half times as much if you took your $100,000 and employed it through real estate. And, you know, why is that? Well, when you're investing in real estate, you know, you make money both on like the actual return. So like you buy a house and then you hold on to it for like 6, 7, 8, 10 years, and then you sell it for more money. So you make a profit that way. You are going to make more profit because you are getting to deduct from your taxes things like insurance and property taxes, expenses related to, you know, buying the house, renting out the house. So then if you're renting it out, you can further take depreciation deductions on your taxes. You have tenants who are paying your mortgage now, and so they're going to pay down the mortgage balance with their money, not your money, and they're paying you rent. And then, you know, even if it's not cash flowing at the beginning, rents go up about 3.5% on average per year. So over the course of time, those rents are going to get higher, but the mortgage payment will always stay the same. And so each year you'll get slightly more cash flow, right? So there's tons of different ways that you can make money in real estate as opposed to, you know, in the stock market, like price goes up and they pay dividends. So there's two ways. So, you know, it kind of starts to make sense why you could get a higher return on investing in real estate. You know, and then finally, the real sort of like kicker is that you can use leverage for real estate. And, you know, when you recognize that and you start to understand how to like use these numbers and metrics, then it really blows your mind, right? Because with $100,000 cash, I can buy $100,000 worth of stocks. I could do, you know, I could do options contracts, which could, you know, it could magnify my exposure. You know, an options contract is equivalent to 100 shares, but like I still couldn't, if I wanted to exercise, you know, a call that I hold for buying stock through an options contract, I still have to have the cash to buy the stock when I exercise my contract. So I've always got to have that cash. Whereas in real estate, we get to use leverage. You know, in the typical or classical is 5-to-1, right? If you put 20% down, you can get 5 times as much as you have. And so in this case, you have $100,000 cash. You use it to put 20% down on a property. That means you get a $500,000 property. And so now when you're getting, you know, rents, when you're getting deductions, and when the value of the property is going up and then you sell it in the future, you get the profits on all $500,000 instead of just the $100,000. And that leverage is what, you know, is typically the difference maker and allows you to get these sky high returns on investment when you're in real estate. And then, you know, that brings us full circle to the VA loan, right? And if you're using a VA loan with 0%, 5%, or 10% down, you know, that's the equivalent of not 5-to-1 ratio leverage, but 10-to-1, 20-to-1, or infinite, right? If you get a really good deal and the appraised value of the property you want to buy is, let's say, $240,000, but because it's kind of dated, needs some work, and the yard is, you know, full of weeds and rocks and doesn't look good, it's got a terrible curb appeal, the listing on Zillow was done by somebody's iPhone instead of a pro, and you are going to get that house for $220,000. Well, now that the appraisals come back at $240,000, you can actually have the VA loan take all of your closing costs, put it in the loan, and now they'll give you a loan for like $230,000, and you will literally have $0 out of pocket, and you'll have $10,000 in instant equity. And over time, it'll just grow and grow and grow on $0 down. And for anybody out there who knows a little bit of math, if it's the denominator is zero, then the returns are infinite, right? And so that's sort of like this ultimate goal of all real estate investors, is to figure out how they can buy real estate without any of their own money, either using, you know, 100% financing or other people's money, raising money through syndications, all this, you know, kind of varsity level stuff that we're not there yet. But really what I wanted to, you know, communicate is, when you look at how far you can take it in terms of sophistication and complexity of putting together a real estate portfolio and an investment strategy, you know, the sky's the limit. And over the years, you can just grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And then eventually one day you're sitting on several millions of dollars worth of equity in your properties, and you have passive income in the tens of thousands of dollars a month. And you can do that in, you know, I would say, like, somebody who's not being uber aggressive can do that in like 10 to 15 years. If you're being really aggressive, like 5 to 10, it could be possible. There are a few people who have done it in just a, you know, like 24 months. Like, I went from 0 to 40 rentals and I'm financially free in 24 months. Like, yeah, some people do that, but, you know, compared to other forms of investing, real estate's pretty great. And so that's why we're just right in the middle of talking about real estate for the military. And this is our third in a series of what I expect to be 5 podcasts talking about that specific topic. And so today's, you know, the first one, we kind of just talked about the where it all started and what the real core foundation of a real estate transaction is, and like how it starts with the land and you build up to the structure, and then how the structure's condition is, and then how the structure has been improved. And instead of looking at the shiny curb appeal and like working down, the real legal and financial process and what's called due diligence, which basically just means checking and rechecking your work and making sure you're not getting a bad deal, that actually starts at the ground, and then the foundation, and then the walls, and then the finishings. And, you know, it's like kind of the opposite of how you look at a house on Zillow. And then in our podcast last week, we talked a lot about two things in particular. And one was, we talked about how you can kind of do your prep work and homework. And so, you know, if you're planning to PCS in the summer of 2025, like right now is a great time to start doing your homework, where you do those sort of, you open up Zillow, you know, and I forgot to mention it, but like usually people on Zillow, they only use the for sale or the rent tabs, but they also have a sold tab. And so you go to the top of the page and you click on the sold, and then you use the filters to just narrow it down. And, you know, if you're looking for a 2 or 3 bedroom, like look at all the 2 and 3 bedrooms that have been sold in the last 6 months. If it's a really busy big market, look in the last 90 days, because things can change more and more quickly. But in a typical military town, like looking over the last 6 months is probably the best, because you'll kind of get like what happened last summer and what's going on in the fall. And that'll help you start to get a good idea of what you should be paying on a square footage basis, as well as for like what you get, you know, like not all houses are equal. So you got to kind of work on that riddle yourself. And then you will have done all this homework. You'll know what a fair value is for a house before you even contact an agent, before you even contact a seller and go out and try to start buying that house. And that'll make it a lot easier on you. You'll be able to spot from a mile away a bad deal. You'll be able to sniff out a good deal. And you'll also be able to be in better control of the process, right? And so that was sort of the last big topic of last week's episode. Which we even called like choosing your team, which is to literally stay in control of the whole process and like, you know, interview your agent, interview the loan officer. Maybe you get reached out to directly by the title officer, the escrow officer, and they got some questions. Like take the time to ask them some questions too. Like make sure everything is lined up and that you trust these people. They know what they're talking about. And especially if you're using a VA loan, they know how the VA loan works. And so today, what I want to do is we're going to build one more layer on it, right? So we started with the fundamentals, the foundational understanding of what real estate transaction is in the United States. Then we talked about how you can prepare yourself and do some homework and how you can interview your team. And then today, what we're going to talk about is the actual things that you should do or be considering once you're actually, you know, like out there actively bidding on real estate. And even like putting in an offer, getting under contract. We're going to talk about some of the terms, and we're going to talk about a few things to like tips and strategies that you can use in that, you know, the bidding and buying process. And then we're going to end by talking about this mysterious thing called like at the close or closing, right? So before we get into it for today, I want to encourage everybody to again, head over to www.militarywealthcoach.com where you can opt into our weekly newsletter and you can also sign up for a free coaching session with me. We'll set it up on Google Meets or Zoom or maybe even Microsoft Teams. I still have that on my phone from like during COVID and using it with the Marine Corps, which is kind of crazy because that's the last time I used it, I think. And then you can also find links to all of our socials out there. So generally you can find us pretty easy if you on any social platform from X to LinkedIn to Facebook to Instagram to TikTok. If you search for Military Wealth Coach or MWC112358. And lastly, you know, honestly, if you're here listening to the podcast, would really appreciate your help with the reviews, right? Like 5-star reviews are awesome, whether it's on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. You go over there, 5 stars. Don't have to say much, just like, you know, one sentence, one liner about like, I really learned a lot about this, or it's awesome, gouge. Wish I would have known this when I was in boot camp or something like that. And then set yourself up with one challenge for this coming week as we head into December Find one person at your unit, or maybe if you know you're at the schoolhouse, a fellow classmate, somebody from another service, even you know, just like a battle buddy, who you think would definitely benefit from financial education for the military and increasing their financial IQ and learning more about real estate, and share the podcast with them so we can grow the community, grow the network, and get more listeners, and eventually we'll get it out there to everybody. And also, of course, we got to do the standard disclosure that the content of this episode is educational and informational in nature. None of it should be misconstrued as legal, tax, or financial advice. As always, do your own research, make your own decisions, and of course, own the consequences of those decisions. All right, so here we are. So we're talking now. We are really far into it. You know, if you can kind of envision the process, we understand what we're getting into with real estate and deeds and titles showing ownership, as well as these really important things to inspect it, to do your title research, which is an ownership and encumbrance report or title report, to make sure that there's not back taxes, that there's not a lien or a mortgage, that there's not a judgment, that the person selling it to you is the rightful owner, and to also do a, you know, inspect the quality of the building that's on the land, to get an appraisal, right? And one of the things that, you know, I didn't say when we were talking about the O&E report or title report, in addition to, you know, finding out about back taxes or liens or other judgments, a lot of times in there from the title work, you'll find out if there are things called like easements. And easements can be really kind of scary, and you have to watch out because, for example, we purchased a place that was bordering on a wetland, right? And so it had some easements in there that said, like, you cannot, you know, alter this part of your yard within, like, a certain distance of this boundary marker because then that could cause erosion that goes into the wetlands, which are protected area. You might also find, you know, especially around some military towns, sometimes there's an easement in there about, like, that just informs you that maybe, like, 75 years ago, there was, like, a dry cleaning business, like, in this area, and there are known to be pollutants in the area. And if you have, you know, a bunch of small kids running around in the backyard, that might be, like, as soon as you see that from the title work, that might be, like, cut and run. Like, we're not going to live here. We're not going to raise our kids here. Even if nothing bad does happen, we just don't want to take the risk, right? So a lot of good comes out of that. And then you got the foundations down. You started to learn how to do your own research and due diligence and things to look for. And then, you know, we talked about questions to ask your team to screen them. Now, what we've done is we've taken the things that we talked about, like those specific questions that you want to ask about your agent or your loan officer when you're kind of putting a team together, and we turned it into like a checklist and put that on the blog. And so you can just like check out our blog from this past week where you look at that checklist, and then also it should be linked. It worked for me, but I haven't got any feedback, positive or negative, but we linked it as like a downloadable PDF, so you can read it, but you can also click and download the PDF and then print it out and take it with you, you know, or print it out and put it on the table or the counter with your partner as you're like going through all the things you got to try to get lined up for your real estate purchase, and use it, right? Good old fashioned pen and paper. So here we are, right? Like maybe you're listening, but you're also on your laptop and you're kind of like clicking through on Zillow and like messing around and doing some stuff and kind of actively looking and thinking. And so today, the things we're going to talk about are, I kind of came up with like 5 C's. Again, it's in our military DNA. Like we can't just let it go, right? We have to always come up with something like an acronym or like a new, you know, a new term or phrase. And I was like, well, I'll try it. I never got any awards for making PowerPoints like they hand out in the Air Force, but, what I came up with are the 5 C's of real estate for the military: contact, contract, contingencies, commissions, and close. So what do I mean by contact? So contact is, I couldn't think of a word that started with C for like negotiations or making offers. So I contact, like you're contacting the seller. And the reason why I want to talk about that is, there's some really good like tips and TTPs in here that you should be using, but most first time or like new home buyers don't know them. They don't get it, right? And it's not that anybody's dumb. It's just that you have to like kind of not only have heard about it and maybe seen others do it, but you also kind of need the numbers for proof. And so what I want to talk about is this thing that is really popular amongst real estate investors when you contact the seller, when you're getting ready to make the offer, right? And so in the contact phase, you want to say, and whether it's you directly or your agent's doing it for you, find out why the seller is selling, right? That's number one. Before you even say, like, why do you want that price or I want to offer this price, ask why they're selling. And there's an adage in real estate that says sellers lie, but buyers are worse. And that's probably true. You're probably not going to get a fully straight shot, but you might, especially if you're buying in a military town. And the reason why I say this right off the bat is to ask them why they're selling is you're trying to gauge their level of desperation. And their level of desperation will let you know how much leverage you have when you make your offer. All right. So here's a couple examples of what I mean by that. We it's almost 3 years ago now, we started getting into Airbnbs and we bought a property, you know, and this is still in the middle of the pandemic. And the sellers had bought this really cute little cabin, you know, my wife, it's like my wife's, you know, future forever home. It's probably too small for that. But anyway, you know, she's obsessed with it. But they had bought it like within the first 3 months of COVID because they were living in a big city. Their employer went full-time remote and they're like, sweet, we can go live in the mountains in this little, you know, village, little town, mountain town by ourselves and do everything. And they were super stoked. So they went out, they did it. And then, you know, 8-9 months later, their employer's like, everybody back to the office. And they're like, oh no, we can't commute, you know, like 6 hours each way every day. And so they had to sell because they were moving like for work. So they didn't get fired. They were moving like right away. And, you know, we talked because of that, we managed to get the price down on that property about $70,000 from what they were asking. Like they were just so desperate. We had the leverage, right? Another thing that you can find out sometimes when you ask why is the seller selling, and this is another example more recently from a property that we ultimately did not purchase, but you know it was a really good looking deal. It seemed to be compared to everything around it. It seemed to be like an awesome investment property for either buy and hold or to just like fix it up a little bit and sell it. And it was like, well, hey, look, the owner passed away. And so it's already gone through probate in the courts where the court said, yep, you know, your will is valid. The owner, you did own this house and you wanted it passed to your son. So yes, your son can take ownership. And the son wanted to sell it. He didn't want to deal with it. And so we're like, sweet, this is a great deal. But then ultimately, like he did a little homework and he found out how much he could get if he sold it after fixing it up a little bit. And so then, you know, we didn't end up making a deal, but you can often find really good deals when the owner's passed away and it goes to kids who don't want anything to do with it. And then, you know, in contrast, like, you know, maybe you hear that the person's selling because they're PCSing, right? And that's, we're going to talk about this in our fifth episode in terms of like important strategies for using the VA loan and how to make sure you can continue to use it over and over in the military. But a lot of times, you know, military family will come into a town, they'll find out how much they can borrow. And they'll, you know, they'll use like $500,000 of their VA credit or, you know, maybe only 250, but they're maxing out their, what they can qualify for. And then when they PCS to a new town and they want to buy a house, they don't have any more debt they can qualify to take on, so they can't get another loan. So they have to sell the first house, right? And we're going to talk about how to get around that and whatnot in episode 5. But again, especially PCSing between military towns, you find out like, oh, this person's PCSing, they got to sell. Like, they need to buy a house and you know, they're, the wife is pregnant with their second or third kid and they need to, you know, buy a bigger house in their next duty station, or even maybe they're just staying put, but that because of the, you know, the new baby, they want a bigger house and they want to get out now and they got to sell. So that's a really important first step. Now, once you figure that out, then you want to go into making an offer, right? And you've already done your homework that we've talked about. You spent months doing your homework, figuring out what reasonable values are for a house. So you're probably already in the right ballpark. And at this point, I want you to take a serious consideration for what, again, real estate investors, it's a very popular tactic, and it's called pricer terms, right? So when somebody's selling something, they want a price. Let's say they want $320,000 for this house, three bed, one bath, $320,000. And you might be, you know, through your desktop appraisal, you know, going through on Zillow, you figured out, like, you know, that's a little high. It's not unfair, but it's a little high. I would expect it to be more like 305 or 310. We're in the right ballpark. So, you know, I think it's worth 310, or I think it's worth 315 is what I'm willing to pay. I know it'll appraise for that much, so I'm not worried about using my VA loan. But 320 is a little high. Like, they're a little aggressive, and I need to talk them down. You know, a lot of times when you get into that, you're just going to make a straight offer. You'll be like, well, I'll offer you $310,000. And they'll come back and be like, well, we'll take $317,500. You know, and you're like, what? Aren't you at least going to meet me in the middle? Well, you know, people do strange things, and haggling about $1,000 when you're spending $500,000 is still something people do. And you may not be able to come to terms on that, right? In which case, you just, you know, politely let them know, like, hey, you're just asking too much for this house. It's not worth it. We can't make it work. But let's say that you do get into a situation where, you know, especially PCS time in the summer, somebody's got a nice house, you know, down there in North Carolina or Texas or something like that. And, you know, we could pick Texas, like Waco. There's army bases out there and stuff. They got a pretty nice little two-bed, two-bath, you know, townhouse or something that they're selling. And they want 320. You know that it will appraise for 320 because you've done your homework. And it's obviously going to be pretty popular, because that price point is right around a $2,000 mortgage, right? Mortgage payment. So a pretty good population of, like, staff NCOs and company grade officers who are going to be able to cover that with their BAH. And so it's an attractive price point because the mortgage payment is affordable. And it's a nice location, nice house, right? So you know that it's going to be kind of highly sought after, right? Like, they're going to get lots of offers. And so this is where price and terms, if you understand this, can come in, and you can make a really, really competitive offer to that seller where you just say, like, hey, look, I don't want to haggle with you on price. I think it's going to appraise for that. I think it's a fair value. I think you should, you know, not have the stress of trying to, like, negotiate the price, but I just want to set the terms. And they'll be like, okay, well, what is it? We're like, we'll give you the 320, but we want $5,000 in cash at close in seller credits, right? Now, what does that mean? So you could try to haggle the price down to $315,000, right? So in your mind, you're like, I don't want to pay $320, I want to pay $315. If you do that, the actual monthly payment of principal and interest for a loan for $320,000 VA loan at the current rates of 6.06% on a 30-year VA fixed, it's $1,930 a month. It's $1,901 a month if you get them down to $315,000. So you would save $30 per month or $360 per year if you successfully get them to come down from $320,000 to $315,000. Because in your mind, you have just gotten $5,000 off of that sale price. But the way it pans out for you in your payments is you only save $360 per year, $30 a month. Like, that's, you know what, that's like lunch for two. If on the other hand, you were to say, I'll give you the price, $320, but I want $5,000 in seller credits, that comes back as $5,000 cash that pays some of your closing costs, right? So you actually have the effect of, at the time of buying the house, keeping $5,000 in your pocket, right? So for them, for you, it's $315 no matter what. The difference being you keep $5,000 in your pocket versus just saving $360 in mortgage payments over the first year. you know, in which case you'd have to own the house for like 14 years just to get that $5,000 in actual cash, right? Which is kind of ridiculous and unreasonable. And for the seller, you know, they will be, maybe they're feeling really happy that they're getting the price they asked. You know, they wanted 320. I didn't want to haggle. We got 320. What's a little bit of cash at closing giving up? It's not, you know, for them, they're still going to walk away making maybe $40,000 or $50,000 instead of $45,000 or $55,000, but they're going to feel okay. And then one thing you can do with that also is maybe they don't really like the idea of cash back at close or cash credit. You can ask them to pay points. Now, mortgage points are usually, it costs 1% of the sale price for one mortgage point, and one mortgage point usually lowers your interest rate by 0.25%. So what you could also do is you could say, okay, we'll still give you $320,000, but I'd like you to put that money, $5,000, towards paying down 2 points on the mortgage rate, right? Well, those 2 points will save you $100 a month or $1,200 per year, because your principal and interest will go from 1930 down to 1830. Well, it costs $6,400, which means you had to put $1,400 in and they put $5,000 in. So for them, it's still the same terms, right? But you're saving $100 a month, which means after 14 months, you're gonna have made back your $1,400. And then every month thereafter, you're saving $100 on your mortgage or $1,200 a year. Now, $100 a month, again, $30, $100 a month doesn't sound like a lot, but when you add it up over the course of 1 year, or in this case, say one PCS cycle, you know, that's like enough for a vacation. You're going to have $2,000 or $3,000 cash from what you saved. So when it comes to contact, those are like the two big things that you want to be thinking about is, one, ask them, always ask why they're selling. It doesn't hurt. They could say like, none of your business, I don't care. They could ignore you, but it never hurts to ask. And then two is to see if there's a way that, you know, if you're close enough that you can give them the price they want and then get the terms that you want, which is cash back or having them pay points or having them, you know, buy you a whole home warranty, give you a repairs and renovations credit. You know, we've done that before. We purchased a property from a builder and they didn't want to budge on price. They didn't want to buy points. They didn't want to do anything. But we said like, well, how about you give us $7,500 in builder credits for upgrades? And they're like, okay, we can do that. So then we had them go and put brand new LVP, high-end LVP flooring throughout instead of the carpet. And it looked, you know, the house looked amazing with that. It's just a way that you can get something that you want and let the seller get the price. And that tends to really go well when you think of a seller who might, their agent might be bringing them 3 offers in 1 day. And one person's offered 310, one person's offered, you know, 312.5. And you said, we'll give you full price. We just want you to pay the points, right? So that's what we wanted to really think about in contact. And then the next is contract, right? So contract is you're going to have a purchase and sale agreement or a contract that you sign that is committing both parties, the buyer and the seller, to this real estate transaction, right? And usually in that contract, it's going to give all these terms. It's going to be like, this is the closing date. Now, closing date, we'll get to that a little bit later in with some other things to think about. But closing is the day that everybody signs the documents, the money gets transferred, you get the deed to the land, the mortgage is opened at the bank in your name, you get the keys from your agent, and you can move in. So closing is like a big, happy day for you. Lots going on, lots of, you know, the title company is going to bring you like 6 pens because you're going to go through them when you're signing like 50 pieces of paper. If you're buying it with your partner, you're each going to sign it. You know, it gets pretty crazy. But that's a kind of countdown. And usually it's going to be 30 to 35 days from the contract date. And the contract date is going to list the price and any terms. And then it's going to list these things, which is our third C, contingencies, right? And so one of the things we mentioned last week in our second episode was that once you start to understand the importance of doing an inspection to make sure that the foundation's good, the wiring is up to code, the plumbing is new, that there's not, you know, that the roof is not bad, that the heating and cooling system's not bad, that the water heater is not bad. You know, checking all these things, it can be multiple thousands of dollars of repairs later or worse. You know, you got to check all that stuff. And those are called contingencies. And during COVID and even today in certain markets that are really popular and lots of competition for housing, buyers are still putting offers where they're saying, I waive my contingencies. I will not inspect it. I will not have an appraiser come out. I won't do a lead test. I won't do a radon test. I won't do anything. I just want this house. Well, that's really good for the seller, right? It's really bad for you as a buyer. And what's important to remember is that if you're going to make money in real estate, whether it's just buying one house at a time that you live in for a few years and then sell, or actually becoming a real estate investor and buying rental properties and all that stuff, you make your money on the purchase. If you waive your contingencies and you buy a property that has $25,000 of repairs you got to do, you're starting out at a $25,000 loss. If you overpay because you're desperate and you can't just like humble yourself and get like a smaller house or like a slightly older house or one that doesn't have all the nice new fixtures and finishes because, you know, it's your first house or your second house and you're 27 and you overpay, you could be underwater on your mortgage. You know, one of the common things that I saw when I came in to the Marine Corps, right at the beginning of like the housing collapse and the Great Recession, was that within a couple of years, there were a bunch of, you know, like O2s and O3s and O4s in the unit who, like, they had dark circles under the eyes, they were shaky and stuff, and it's because they had purchased, really big new homes in California, Florida, wherever, in, like, 2002, 2003 when they were lieutenants, you know, and they way overpaid because they were buying at the peak of a bubble. It wasn't their fault, right? But here they were, like, 4 or 5 years later, and they were going to lose $50,000 on the sale because they just got caught up in the hype and they overpaid and they waived contingencies. And so you never want to do that, right? You want to make sure that when you go into this contract that you give yourself a set inspection period, a set time for the appraisal, a set period of escrow. Like escrow is a period when you can get out of it, essentially. So you might put a thing called earnest money down when you sign the contract, which says like, I'm serious. So it might be like $1,500 cash that you put in escrow. And escrow just means it's like a third party managing the bank account. So you're not giving it directly to the seller. So they can't keep it if the contract cancels. And this escrow agent will either give it back to you if you find a reason to get out of the contract, or once it finally comes to closing day, they'll include that in what's owed. So you don't have to like pay it twice, right? But you want to make sure that all these things are in there and that you're not waiving them so that you have the chance to do your research, to get the inspection done, to get the appraisal back, and to make up your mind if you want to go forward in the contract. Last thing you want to do is sign a contract that doesn't have, you know, and this is why we, you know, and our agent question checklist is like, ask them how long it takes them to schedule an inspector or a VA appraiser, right? It can get pretty ugly if, you know, and as I shared last week, like we ran into trouble closing once because we didn't ask the loan officer if they had a VA certified appraiser. So they just ordered an appraisal from a non-VA certified appraiser, came back, then the VA rejected it, and we had to reschedule it. And fortunately, the seller was kind enough to amend the contract and give us an additional 10 days for our due diligence period so we could get the new appraisal back and make sure everything checked the boxes. But you can just imagine if you waive these things, if you give away your contingencies, if you give away the outs that you have, and then something comes back and it doesn't work out, like you're either screwed with buying this house that's overpriced or in bad condition or you don't want, or you're screwed, you're going to lose your earnest money deposit, right? So when it comes to contract and contingencies, they go hand in hand. You want to keep your contingencies in your contract. You want to make sure the contract's written out with like reasonable timelines. And one of the things that's worth taking a look at is when you're on Zillow, when you're looking at things, you can show like there's a box under filters where you can click like include under contract, include show pending. And what that means is if somebody makes an offer and the seller accepts it, they're going to sign the contract. And you're going to see that the status of the listing on Zillow is under contract. What that means is, all that means is that the seller agreed to terms with the buyer, but they're still got it. They're still going through all their contingency periods. There hasn't been an inspection. There hasn't been a appraisal, you know, anything like that. And so that can be an opportunity. Like, don't just move past that, right? You might be able to say like, hey, can you send a backup offer over to the seller? We really like this house. We think we can make a good offer. And, you know, during that contingency period, you know, it's not just that the house could fail, but the buyers could fail. Like, the buyers could still fail to qualify for a loan, in which case the contract's broken and the house goes back on the market. But if you had your agent find some under contract and send over a backup offer, it might not ever come back up as active on Zillow. They might just come straight to you and take your offer, right? Well, once all of those contingencies are met, so you sign the contract, you have your contingencies, your due diligence, inspection, appraisal, et cetera, it changes from under contract to pending. And that means that all of the things that you've wanted to check out have met the standard. And now you're just waiting to clear the financing and complete the sale. And again, it's worth looking at those on Zillow because some buyers may not ultimately qualify for their financing, and they may not be able to secure the purchase. So again, it's worth taking a look at. And for you as well, just realize like you might still see that property that you are trying to buy as listed for sale, but know that you're somewhere, you know, so long as there's a signed contract, it is under contract. The seller is obligated to sell it to you unless there's a reason to back out, which is all in the contract, right? Okay. So we've gone through, you've kind of like sounded out the seller, why they're selling. You've tried to get a nice price for terms offer that makes both parties happy. You sign the contract, you keep your contingencies, you go through, you get the inspection, you get the appraisal, everything's checking out, the title work checks out, and now you're pending sale, right? And so now you're in the countdown. You're like, okay, now I'm no longer talking to the agent, I'm no longer talking to title, I'm no longer talking to escrow, I'm no longer talking to seller. These last few days, you know, 5 to 10 days in the home stretch, this is all about getting to closing date. And it's pretty much you and the loan officer going back and forth, because at this point, the loan officer is going to update all of their files on you, get updated LESs, get updated, you know, bank statements, whatever, and make sure they're going to do this final check to make sure you qualify for your loan. The VA is going to review the appraisal, and they're going to let the bank know that they back it up. And so it's all about the money at this point. And at some point, a few days before the actual close, when you actually make the final, you know, money transfer, sign the deed, sign the title, sign all of the loan paperwork, and get the keys to your new house, you're going to get what's called a closing disclosure. All right. The closing disclosure is important. You should always look at it. And you should also find somebody to talk about it with, right? Because to be honest, sometimes they're not totally transparent. But a closing disclosure is going to be several pages. And the first one, when you open it up, you're going to see the loan terms and the projected payments and the costs at closing. So sort of like the wave tops. And you want to make sure, like, okay, is this, you know, have they checked the right loan type, that it's a VA and not a conventional? Am I getting, because a VA is going to have a lower interest rate and it's going to have the VA guarantee. So, you know, you want to make sure that that the type of loan is on there. You want to make sure the interest rate lines up with what you're expecting. If you made a deal, you know, if you know right now that the VA 30-year loan interest rate is 6.06% and you made a deal that the seller was going to pay 2 points to bring your interest rate down half a percentage point to 5.56%, and you don't see that on the closing disclosure, you should immediately push back to the loan officer and be like, hey, that's not the interest rate, you know. Sometimes the banks will have you pay money up front to lock in an interest rate. You know, if you think the economy's, you know, going in like really strong and like the interest rates might be going up, you know, it might pay to lock the interest rate when you sign the contract, but that's, you know, that's a little bit advanced, something to talk about separately. But you want to make sure that the loan terms are correct, and then you're going to look at the projected payments and make sure you can afford it, right? Because it's going to include how much each month the bank is going to charge on top of the principal and interest, because they're going to collect what's called escrow money, which is tax and insurance, and then they pay that directly for you. So you want to double check that. And then you're also going to want to double check where it has mortgage insurance. Now, normally, if you have a conventional loan and you put less than 20% down, you have to pay mortgage insurance. But the VA loan, you don't, right? So again, this is how familiar and how locked on your loan officer is. If you're using the VA loan, double check. There should never be mortgage interest listed on your closing disclosure. All right. And then you're going to see closing costs and cash to close. Now, what that means, closing costs are all of the different fees for like the title paperwork, the title insurance, the recording fees, things that we've talked about. You're going to pay a few months of property taxes in advance. You're going to pay at least 1 month of interest on your loan in advance. You're going to pay 3 months to maybe a year of your homeowner's insurance in advance. And those are all closing costs that you have to pay. If you're paying any money towards points, that'll be there. And then cash to close is like all of your closing costs plus any down payment minus any earnest money. So if you put $1,500 in earnest money down, you're doing a zero down VA loan and you have $6,000 in closing costs, your cash to close should be $4,500, right? Because you've already put $1,500 in earnest money that will now get credited back to you. So make sure that lines up, right? Like make sure that the escrow officer didn't lose your earnest money deposit and make sure it's properly credited back. Right, and then you're also going to pay, in the case of, you know, you'll move on to the second page where it starts, it's got like all these tiny lines. You're like, I don't understand this. Why are there 18 different things about title? Why are there 15 different things about insurance and taxes? Like, I don't get all this. Some things are called like things you shopped for, things you didn't shop for. The reality is like pretty much all of it, you don't shop for it, right? But you're paying for credit, your credit report, you're paying for the you know, document fees, right? Like they'll charge you like $60 for printing all these papers. You know, it's just part of the game. But just be aware that because you're using a VA loan, there is going to be a funding fee on there, right? So that's why we say like it's never totally a zero down loan with the VA loan, because in the case of your first use of the VA loan, if you try to do 0% down, you're going to still pay 2.15% as a funding fee. So, you know, on this $320,000 house in Waco, Texas, you're going to pay about $7,000, maybe a little less than $7,000 in VA funding fees, right? So check that. And it's important also that you Google the VA funding fee tables. They're updated pretty much every year. Because if you put 5% or 10% down, the VA funding fee is lower. After your first use, so let's say you've already used a VA before, you're going to use it again, you still want to put 0% down, your funding fee is going to be 3.3%, right? At which point, maybe you should just put like 5 or 10% down and pay a lower funding fee, because the funding fee just goes to the VA. You're never going to get that back. And make sure also, if you're a veteran, obviously, if you're a veteran with more than 10% disability rating, then the funding fee is waived. So the VA loan gets super awesome, like super black belt ninja level for you if you are a disabled veteran, because now you can do 0% down, 0% funding fee. All right, but as you're walking through your closing disclosure, just like check all that stuff out. There's a column for you and there's a column for the seller. So if you have terms that the seller's going to give you a whole home insurance policy, or they're going to give you cash back at close, or they're going to buy down the points, make sure that you see that in the seller paid column, right? You have to double check all of these things to make sure you don't get hosed when you actually are at the sale. And then it'll break it down and do summaries and you know, calculations and all that stuff. And you can get out a calculator if you want, but at that point, you know, it's not like anybody else is using a calculator. So long as they input the right data on the first two sheets, then, you know, the rest of the disclosure will correctly calculate and you don't have to stress too much. Now the fifth C, and it kind of sneaks in there, is commissions. And commissions are an important thing to take a look at. And normally, up until 2023, probably wouldn't have thought twice about it. And it probably wouldn't have made the list of like the five C's that you have to pay attention to. But as of 2023, it certainly does. Now, why do I say that? Well, the practice amongst real estate brokers and real estate agents is that they have charged commissions to both the buyer and the seller. Now, why is that a weird thing to do? It's a weird thing to do because the sellers are the ones who are, they're marketing the property, the seller's agent, they're marketing the property, they do the staging, they do all of the work to get it set up, they put it online on what's called a multiple listing service, and then they're providing a pretty decent service there, and depending on the state, they're going to get 2.5% or 3% commission of the sale price. So on a $320,000 home, let's just say 3%, you know, they're going to make $9,600 on seller's agent commissions. Well, kind of what happened is amongst realtors and brokers, because it's not like one agent or realtor only sells and one only buys, they do both of it. So they realize like, hey, if we work together, we can also get the same fee collected from buyer's agents, right? And so, again, depending on the state, 2.5% or 6% on, or 2.5% or 3% on each side, meant that on every single transaction, the total commissions charged by the agents would be 5% or 6%. So now, on this $320,000 house, a 6% total commission split half between the buyer and the seller's agent, that would be $19,200. And that the seller has to pay that. So $320,000, even if they didn't know anything on the mortgage, they're automatically paying $19,200 to the agents as a commission, which means on that $320,000 sale, they're only making $300 at the most, let alone all the other costs, right? And the Supreme Court basically came out and they ruled, I think it went to the Supreme Court. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, it went into federal courts, either U.S. District or all the way up to Supreme Court. And basically what happened is you had all these people who were like, look, with Zillow, we found the house ourselves. We came up with the offer ourselves. We negotiated the sale directly. Like we had an agent, but the agent didn't find us this property. They did nothing for us to buy this property, and yet you're still automatically charging us this additional commission, doubling down on the commission to pay our agent. And we think that that's unfair. And in court, it was determined like, yes, this is price fixing, collusion, monopolistic behavior. It's not fair. You can't do it anymore. And so since this landmark case, which is known as NAR for National Association of Realtors case, they agreed to pay back to many of these people who filed the suit, pay back commissions to them. But then also it became now sort of like the Latin term would be like de jure, like, or sorry, de facto, that like sellers on a closing document, the only thing that can really be there, closing disclosure, is the 3% seller's agent fee. You can't just force the buyer's agent fee onto somebody. And so everybody thought like, oh, that's awesome, right? Because now I'm only going to pay a 3% commission. Well, what do you think the buyer's agents did now that they weren't getting commissions? Well, they stopped working, right? They were literally like, you know, the practice late in 23 and early 24 that came out of this was like the seller got to determine, they got to say like how much they were going to pay from 0 to 3% to the buyer's agent, because it's coming out of their pockets, right? Somebody selling a $320,000 house, they're either going to have to pay $9,600 in commissions to their seller, no matter what, to their seller's agent. But now they could choose, do I want to pay the other $9,600 to the buyer's agent? And a lot of them said, like, no, of course not. I want to keep that $10,000 in my pocket. But then what happened is the buyer's agent would not even, they wouldn't even share these listings with their clients. They wouldn't take them on showings. They weren't trying to, like, push it. They were like, I'm not making any money. What incentive do I have? And so you had sellers start to come back and say, like, okay, how about 1.5%? And they're like, sure. If we run into somebody, sure, we'll send them your way. We could probably do a showing once, right? And they're like, oh, I need to sell my house. What if I just give you the 3%? And they're like, sure, awesome, dude. Thanks for the money. We'll bring our clients over tomorrow, right? And so it's worth being aware that, you know, when you get the contract and the closing disclosures, like, you need to look for what the seller is paying out. Ultimately, they're going to pay it out from their share, so whatever. But when it comes back around to your turn to sell this house in a few years, 5, 6, 8, 9 years, whatever it is, you know, you'll remember that, right? You'll remember. And the big picture is that, like, obviously, when it comes to the value of homes and real estate, if a seller's got to pay a 6% commission, that extra 3%, they're going to factor that in, right? Like, they may have wanted $310 for that house, but as soon as they knew that they had to pay $9,600 to the buyer's agent on top of $9,600 to theirs, they moved the price up to $320, right? And so, you know, real estate is always going to be priced a little bit higher than what the actual ground and the building's worth, because sellers are not dumb. They know they got to sell, they've got to pay these commissions. And so they're going to ask more for their house in order to help cover that. All right. So, but yeah, you know, once you review that closing disclosure, you look on there, you make sure that the funding fees are correct, that the interest rates are correct, that any points paid are correct, that any credits from the seller are correct, that your earnest money is on there and it's been applied to the total closing costs, it's been taken away from the total closing costs, and your cash to close is correct. You know, you're going to essentially get the clear to close. And that's usually 1 or 2 days before the actual closing date. And that's when you know that you've been approved for the loan. The bank is happy. They're moving the funds over into an account. And at that point, like, it's all in the bank, right? And you might as well just go out and buy a new, you know, key lanyard so that when you get the keys to your new house, you don't lose them. And yeah, so hopefully today, you know, what we covered was really kind of, again, we haven't spent time getting down in the nitty-gritty of what is a VA loan and what are the different stipulations and things like that. Instead, we've just been talking about the process of understanding real estate, understanding values, understanding how to do your own valuations, how to screen your team, and then how to go about looking like kind of like a, you know, a salty real estate veteran when you're making offers, and then going into your due diligence period, keeping all of your contingencies on the table, because if you're going to make money, you make it at the purchase and not the sale. And so you can't afford to get screwed over on the front end, like whether it's overpaying because the appraisal's not good, or buying, you know, a, kind of like a a junk heap, you know, because you didn't do an inspection and it's got, everything's broken. And getting you all the way to the point of reviewing the loan details and the disclosures to make sure that everything is exactly as you negotiated it and is exactly as you expect it, so that you can get into your house and get a good deal and make money. You know, because in the end, real estate is that direct line for you to financial freedom, especially when you're in the military and you get tax-free BAH to pay your mortgage and you get a VA loan so you can buy your properties with almost no money down. All right. So we're going to come back next week, our fourth week in this series, and we're going to talk specifically about the VA loan and all the things you need to know about it. So I said we hadn't, you know, gotten bogged down, but now we're going to get bogged down. Talk about the different types of VA loans, the joint VA loans, the cash out refi VA loans, the rehab, like renovation rehab VA loans, how to use them, how to get your certificate of eligibility, how to refinance out of them, why you should do that, and when you should do that. And then that'll be, you'll be able to, you already have the kind of like this structure, this outline and understanding, and now you'll just understand the weapon system and how to plug it in there and go out and get a great deal and buy your first house or your next house. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Again, I hope you got something out of it. It's always fun to talk about. And until next time, stay financially fit and mission ready.